Welcome to another Leon Chani report, and I am reporting to you from New York, but I was in Israel for the last 2 weeks, and we have taped some fascinating shows over there. And one is on internet terrorism by Professor Gabriel Weinberg, and Weinman, and he will be on next week. And that's a terrific, terrific show. Unfortunately, it's a very important topic today, and internet terrorism is abounding all over the place. But today we have an eclectic show, and we'll start with Ambassador Chaim Devon, who used to be the ambassador to Canada before they devalued the dollar up there. Then he went back into his foreign ministry, and he runs a special committee. But I want to talk to him really about what he thinks is happening on the foreign policy end of Israel, and A, with the Hamas, B, there's a new election coming up. Put him on the spot a little bit if he can. I know he works for the government, but our show tries to jab a little bit. Hi and welcome. You and I haven't seen each other since you planned a top Jews of the world for Asa Weitzman when he was president, right. And we brought a lot of very important Jews, at least they thought they were in any case, to try and figure how they're going to reorganize the Jewish community. You know, by the way, he's trying to do that now. Is the president, Katsav.
Yes, President Katsav.
I was visited by a fellow from the foreign ministry who's doing this for Katsav
Akiva
now.
Akiva Tor, Mr. Tor.
Right. And he's trying to put sort of, it's very hard to do because unfortunately Jewish people, each guy has a thing called honor and this guy likes honor. So if he can do it, Katsav can go on and be prime minister.
Everyone will get Aliyah, don't worry.
Aliyah?
Everyone is going to get Aliyah.
Aliyah means you're called up to the Torah, the Jewish faith. We don't only broadcast to the Jewish people. Anyway, my understanding of the situation as I was in Israel is sometimes it's better to know your enemy if he's fully exposed than rather doing a tap dance with someone who tells you he's your friend and then he's your enemy behind your back. Without getting specific, would you agree with that proposition?
Well, in principle, yes, but you have to study case by case. I mean, if you refer to the Hamas, for example, I mean, there's certain things that we cannot compromise. And
no, I agree with that.
And therefore, we have to be very tough. Otherwise, what kind of a message we send to the rest of the world? I mean, if we're fighting terrorism, we have to fight terrorism all the way.
All right. Condoleezza Rice has been running around the Middle East trying to get the Arab countries to say that they would not fund Hamas because Hamas is dedicated to the destruction of Israel or not to recognize Israel, period. So she went to Egypt yesterday, and I believe she was turned down. Am I correct?
Well, these are the reports that we're getting, yes.
And she went to Saudi Arabia, and they didn't decide to give money to a Jerusalem shul. They said they'd prefer to give money to Hamas. Explain the reasoning for this. Fundamentalism in their own countries?
Fundamentalism is number one, is at least putting a front that there is kind of an Arab or Muslim solidarity. You don't dictate to us what is happening in our part of the world. This is a type of thing, but I'm sure that deep inside they are worried. They know what does it mean to have Hamas going strong or not being able to tame Hamas or such organizations, because today it's in the PA and tomorrow it's in Saudi Arabia or in Egypt. So therefore, I do hope that quietly they do what they have to do, because otherwise it will spell problems to them just as much as to us.
All right. Were you shocked? You're sitting in the foreign ministry. You shocked that the Hamas won this election, or you had no? Did you have any idea from your people and intelligence, etc.?
We knew that they are getting stronger. We were not sure that they will have such a landslide. That was pretty surprising, but again, you have to analyze what is the reason for that. It's more defiance against the PA, a vote of protest. It does not necessarily mean that that the majority of Palestinians are advocating acts of terror. Exactly.
I said this immediately when the election took place. I said basically socially and economically these people are in terrible shape. The PA has absconded with millions and maybe billions of dollars. There's this whole cartel of the people who run the PA, and everybody's got a pretty good bank account someplace who knows, maybe Bank Leumi, I don't know. But there was a story that Arafat had a bank account in Bank Leumi. You aware of that?
Yeah.
And so when we talk about these things, the people, they need milk for the babies, and they need a roof over their heads, and they need employment. And I think that they were fed up with the corruption and their own authority.
Exactly.
So if Hamas doesn't get enough funding, and they don't pay, they have this payroll all the time. They got a lot of people on the police and, you know, their army, their militia, whatever it is. They don't get paid. What could there be a civil war down there between the factions?
Well, there might be.
That's what I think.
There might be. But all depends. Let's hope that they're becoming pragmatic and they do what the international community and ourselves are expecting them to do and not just play this wild card. And
so what do you expect them to do?
First of all, to renounce terrorism, to change their entire platform, to disarm themselves. I mean, there are certain demands that we
no, but
want
you
to
real, you guys sit in the foreign ministry, so you monitor this all day. Do you really believe that they politically can change their doctrine against the state of Israel? They can do that. You think they can do that midstream? In other words, they would have to do what Arik Sharon did in Israel. Arik Sharon built the settlements in Israel and then said, I got to make a national decision to do something that's for the benefit of the long term of Israel, and I've got to change and take away and remove settlers from Gush Katif. Do you think Hamas, in order to survive and become a political entity, has the capacity to take away its philosophical doctrine against the destruction of Israel?
In theory, they do, because they have the opposition, the Fatah movement, which already did it. So, in theory, they do. The question is, of course, whether they're going to go for it, because here they have two options. Either continue on being radical and therefore alienate themselves from the international community and align themselves with the axis of evil. This is a possibility. And then, of course, the Palestinians, unfortunately, the average Palestinian will suffer, will pay the price, because they will be totally isolated, or that they will have to be to change course and realize that being in opposition is one thing, but taking over and being at the helm is another thing. So we'll have to wait a couple of weeks and see what are the results.
Do you feel that the European countries will support sort of a blockade against funding to the Hamas unless they change their attitude towards Israel?
Well, I hope so, because I'll tell you. First of all, you have to hope. I mean, there's nothing.
I hope we have a great show. But I need you're a sophisticated diplomat.
Right,
you've been around the block.
No. Right now, I'll tell you. Right now, the Europeans understand that things can come around. I mean, they see what's happening in Europe. They see what does it mean to have a radical movement just around the corner. They understand what is the consequences of instability of the region. So I think the Europeans so far are doing the right thing. We listen very carefully to what the Germans are saying, even to what the French are saying. If someone will break the ranks,
I believe the Germans will stay with you with this new
exactly.
Prime Minister. I mean, Chancellor.
But again, we you know, the Middle East is always full of surprises.
Absolutely.
So we do hope that now the experience that we have of the last couple of years, and the recent years in particular, where what the Muslim unrest is all about, what it can bring havoc to mainland Europe, I think should make them go through a very clear path. Not compromise over that.
Are you familiar with this incident in France where a Jew...
Very ugly, yeah. Very tragic, very disturbing, and this is again...
We have to explain that to the audience. A Jewish man... Was
kidnapped. And brutally, and after being held for I think about 2 weeks, he was brutally murdered.
Do they know who did it?
We don't know exactly, but these are groups of young Muslim from North Africa and from mainland Africa, and it just shows you what can happen. And this is they picked him because he was Jewish.
Only because he was Jewish.
And this is absolutely terrible. And therefore, again, it has to be not only we have to be strong, but the governments, and particularly the French government, have to understand what are the ramifications of a strong stance against terrorism, against radicalism.
All right. You were an ambassador to Ethiopia?
Yeah.
How is that? The Ethiopian Jews, are they integrating well into the society?
It takes time, but they're integrating well. Those who are completing the Israeli education system and going through the military service and come out as a young Israeli, proud Israelis after military service, they are great and asset to the Israeli society. And give them some time, they'll do extremely well.
Are you in touch with them all
the
time?
Of course. I live in an area where one of the main absorption centers is in Mevaseret Zion. And to see them always coming fresh and having the first steps, it's just a delight. It's absolute delight.
All right, the foreign ministry. Tell me what you people are doing in terms of Iran now. I mean, he's making tough, violent statements as president. And I think yesterday he made a statement that he blamed the Jews for the burning of the Shiite temple in Iraq. Did you see that?
Yes. Well, nothing will surprise us. I mean, this guy is totally insane, very dangerous. I mean, one thing is to be insane, but another thing is being dangerous. And God forbid, if he is looking for nuclear capability. I mean, just imagine what could be the ramifications there for the stance of the international community. And Israel is part of the international community, of course, has to be a very, very strong, and we cannot afford, as this global village cannot afford, country such as Iran possessing nuclear capability.
All right, I'm going to keep knocking you around a little bit with foreign policy issues. The Soviet Union, not the Soviet Union, Russia, Putin invited the Hamas to visit them in Moscow. A great disappointment to you people?
Yes. Yes, it was.
And indeed, you have pretty good relationships with Russia now, don't you?
Yes, much better than it used to be. We have a good rapport and exchanges, a good dialogue, but yes.
Is this a power play by Putin on the world stage?
Could be that he is telling everyone, listen, I'm still around, I'm a player here, so make sure that I'm included in all the deals, etc. So, and I hope that this is the case, and eventually that he will understand that it's also important for Russia. Because, again, whether it's Hamas or whether Iran going berserk, Russia will pay a price as well. We've seen what's happened with the Chechen rebels. Imagine the Chechen rebels possessing nuclear capability, or imagine them teaming up with Hamas. So we're all in this game, and therefore we all should have a unified stance.
And Abbas is still the president.
Yeah.
So Abbas, like in Israel, they go to the president and form a government. If he forms a government with a prime minister who was from the Hamas party, what is Israel's position on such a government?
As far as Hamas didn't change their basic requires.
Right, no matter if Abbas is president or not.
Yeah, the minute, because see what happens. You have a ministry is run by Hamas people.
Right.
And, how do you deal with the ministry? So there's the problem. I believe Hamas also Abbas also understands that he has a problem. Let's see what, how he's going to go about
it. When I was in Israel, Olmert made a decision to transfer $50 million to Hamas, to the PLO or whatever they were in, because you owed them VAT tax or something, it's their money. Is that policy going to continue, or is that being debated now? What's going to happen
for
the
future? It is being debated, because right now we are not going to transmit those funds to a government which is run by Hamas practically. But
Tzipi Livni, who's your foreign minister now, what was her position? She had a specific position on that.
No, she held the same. She held the same position.
Same position.
Oh yes, absolutely. Here, there's one unified voice, and you cannot deviate, because this is, you cannot set a precedent here. They have to be very firm, and they have to understand that this is a very clear message, not only of Israel but of the international community, and this is what is expected for them. And it's either or, and we have to be very strong about that.
Chaim, good to see you again. Haven't seen you in about 10 years, and that's insight into what the foreign ministry is thinking, which is the government of Israel, which is now led by the acting prime minister, Ehud Olmert. On March 28th, there'll be a huge election over there. He doesn't talk about it, but the polls show that Ehud Olmert today would gain about 40 seats. that the Likud about 15, the Labor Party maybe 18, 19, 20, the Shinui Party, which was Tommy Lapid, has been basically wiped out. He won't be around in the government. So it's a fascinating time. One thing I can guarantee, there'll be a lot of media over there. Everybody's a macher and everybody's a maven. They all know. And if you don't know what my French is, macher, maven, look it up in a dictionary. It's in the Webster. We'll be right back with Paul Maidman, Forbes magazine, the editor of Forbes.com. And he's going to tell us about what has happened economically, and especially with oil, because he is the expert on oil and he's a stalwart on this show. And then he'll talk about the interest rate. We always argue about whether we're in an inverted yield curve or not. And he'll tell me, well, maybe we are, maybe we're not, and what it means. Sometimes it's inflation, deflation, and sometimes relation. We'll be right back.
It's one of the many ways to fight osteoarthritis pain. For more information on managing pain, go to fightarthritispain.org.
Who says you can't teach an old dog new tricks? Maybe you should go to your shelter and get a mature dog who will make your blues disappear. How's that for tricks?
I got picked.
Wow.
Mom, can I have a dollar?
Yeah, it's right. I think my purse is upstairs on the bed.
It's not here.
Check the dining room.
No.
What about your sister's room?
It's not there either.
The upstairs closet? The downstairs closet.
There are no more closets.
Moms everywhere are finding ways to keep kids active and healthy. Get ideas, get involved, get going at letsmove.gov.
Cotton balls. Duct tape. Spoon.
Needle.
Thread. Scalpel.
The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today.
We're back. Always a pleasure to welcome Paul Maidman on the show. You know him. He's a stalwart here. He's editor-in-chief of Forbes.com and knows everything about what's going on in the world economically, in any case. First thing, the port deal. Is that a big issue?
I think it's been blown up into an issue domestically in America.
Let me explain. I say port issue. There's a Dubai company that's been given the ride. I've been out of the country, and I saw this big issue.
A company called Dubai Ports World, which is owned by, essentially controlled by the United Emirates government, the Dubai government, has made a $6.8 billion takeover company for a British firm called P&O, the old Peninsula and Oriental Navigation. They happen to own the rights to manage six big ports in America, including Newark, Los Angeles.
So you mean they inherited it by contract?
They inherited the contracts. They bought the company that had the contracts, so they now come to run the ports, to manage the ports. And of course, the issue has grown up because it's from the United Arab Emirates. Suddenly, America's ports, big ports, are now going to be run by fundamentalist terrorists, which is just nonsense.
So George Bush is right on this.
I think George Bush...
Did he even know it happened?
Apparently he didn't know it had happened. I mean, the process when there's a foreign investment in the United States, there's a nonpartisan committee that Congress set up when America was very worried about Japan taking over everything, which has all the government agencies. They review these deals. They have 30 days to review them. If there's real security concerns, there's a subsequent 45-day review, which didn't happen in this case. It was cleared. I mean, this was a deal that was done last November. This isn't something that suddenly happened. So why it's suddenly blown up now?
Who broke it? I was out of the country. Who broke this?
It emerged as a political row.
I understand, but how did
I think the politicians started it raising it. Earlier this month, the P&O shareholders approved the takeover in a formal meeting, and it came out of that. But as I say, I mean, this is something that anyone who'd been paying attention, it was on the radar since at least last November.
But Hassert, the speaker, and first the majority leader in the Senate, they went out against
Their president.
It's a real local issue.
Right.
It's a real local issue, huh?
It is. I think it's tapping into
the American worker too. Is that what they're fighting for?
Well, no. I think what they're doing is they're tapping into a xenophobic, anti-Muslim strain that runs pretty deep in America, and especially they see it as being a profitable seam to mine in a year when we've got midterm elections, and of course everybody has their eye on the White House in 2008.
So Bush says, you know, he'll veto if they pass a bill against it, he'll veto it, but he'll be overridden if Hassert and First are against it. How can he win?
I mean, possibly. Well, I think to override a presidential veto, and that will be his first veto of congressionally, will be that would be a really big political crisis. So it may not come to that point.
Do you think he'll back off?
I don't know, and I don't think he should back off. I mean, to my mind, the real issue.
You know who's backing him, by the way? Jimmy Carter.
Well, there's a pair of presidents for you.
That's right.
No, I think the thing is, though, that what really we should be paying attention to here is not who manages the ports. And, you know, Dubai Ports World, they've got lots of experience. They manage ports around the world, in Asia, in South America, in Europe, and if this deal comes ahead in North America as well. But what really America should be concentrating on is putting some proper funding into port security. I mean, they should be spending something like $400 million a year to make America's ports secure. That's what the trade lobbies think. And America has been spending somewhere between $90 and $170 million a year. So way below what they need to make the ports really secure. That, I think, is the real weakness that everyone should be focusing on.
So how's this for a prediction? Dubai will sell to Bechtel or Halbitron? And how's that?
Maybe.
Is that a quote for Forbes?
We'll see. I mean, you know, there are serious concerns about the Emirates in terms of their... I mean, there's a lot of smuggling that goes on out of there. It's notorious as a transshipment point for Western goods, often breaking embargoes and sanctions, particularly into Iran. There's a lot of trade between the two countries, a lot of trade to Pakistan, lots of dual-use equipment, you know, ends up in rather dodgy places in the region, and it's come through the ports in the United Arab Emirates. So, you know, there are some legitimate concerns, but it would have been as silly to say P&O shouldn't manage the ports because, you know, the shoe bomber was a Brit, so why have a Brit company manage the ports, as it is to say a couple of the 9/11 bombers came from United Arab Emirates, so therefore their company shouldn't be allowed to operate here.
Now, you're a brilliant guy and you're a journalist. Now, I was in Israel and the big headline was that Dick Cheney shot somebody. This was a bigger headline than the poor things that were happening in Iraq. There were a lot of things going on in the world. Was this a big story?
This was a big story, and it was a big story, I think, not because of the event itself, although I was waiting to see the T-shirt slogans which said, guns don't shoot people, vice presidents do. But I think it was more because this touched into this real concern lots of people have about the secrecy of this administration.
Right.
It wasn't made public until 24 hours, 48 hours after the event. Cheney himself, I don't think, didn't go on television to speak about it until the Wednesday. There's a weekend.
But should he have?
I think had
if you're out socially and you shoot your friend, and you're the vice president, you're not. But if you're the vice president,
I try not to shoot my friends,
right?
Me socially
too.
Or otherwise,
you don't think he did it on purpose?
No, of course not. Of course not. It was an accident. It was very sad. And thankfully, you know, Whittington is well and recovering. But I think it's one of those things that the impression given was here was immediately administration whose first reaction is to go down to lockdown, clamp down the information
on
everything.
But it was really, I mean, was it a big thing? The secret life of Dick Cheney, he didn't disseminate things. Newsweek had a whole cover story on this thing.
Well, I think it's because of the slow way they responded that it blew up. And I think that had they made an announcement straight away, it would have fizzled out as a story. It was a very sad accident.
Does it have any legs, as you say in the media?
I think its legs have probably
broken. Collapsed.
Shot from under it.
All right, let's talk about another very important issue and how that comes into play with oil and economics. Mm-hmm. This Shiite bombing of the Muslim temple. Now, I've been in the Middle East enough to know how holy these edifices and shrines and mosques are. This was a big move, and these moves are usually, they have great plans behind them. They're not simplistic things. Give me your take on this whole thing.
Well, I think this certainly moves Iraq closer to civil war.
Civil
I mean,
war.
I think you're absolutely right. This, you know, this was a big, you know, symbolic hit at a very, very sacred place, and that was not done casually. You know, this was no Cheney-like accident. This was very carefully planned. So I think, you know, I mean, obviously the situation in Iraq is incredibly fragile. In terms of its effects on the oil market, since you mentioned that, I mean, I don't think it's going to have a huge effect beyond keeping the sort of general concern about the Middle East roiling along, partly because Iraq just isn't exporting very much oil anyway at the moment, and partly because the markets have discounted it. I mean, they're far more concerned about what's going on in Nigeria with the taking of the hostages and foreign oil companies there.
Iran. They have the oil, but they don't refine the oil, right? Are they a market player in the world? I mean, if everybody comes out and says, we're going to do economic sanctions against Iran, does that really have any effect?
They're going to be very hard to enforce sanctions. Yeah. And in fact, one of the, I think, laws of unintended consequences at play here is that if the US and Europe tries to put sanctions on Iran, it will force them to turn even more north to Russia, and particularly east to India and China. Both the Indians and Chinese have signed energy deals with Iran. It'll be very hard to police those borders. It'll be very hard to stop the energy going out in that direction.
All right, so what do you do if you're the United States?
I think it's a very, very difficult position, and I think Iran has learned from North Korea that if you have nuclear weapons, you can be...
You've got an ace to play
with. You've got an ace to play with, yeah. And in many ways, I mean, somehow the West in general has got to get Iran into a position where it can be, you know, held and restrained without going the full...
How do you do that?
It's extremely difficult. I don't think the military option is feasible, or it's such a last resort in this case. It's not like going into Iraq. I mean, this would be a very serious war.
I talked to many people in Israel about the possibility of... obviously they have plans. I mean, you can't stand without a plan if the president gets up and says, I want to knock you out. But the feasibility of this stuff is not so simple.
It's very, very difficult.
Very, very complicated. Does Forbes magazine have an editorial policy on this?
I think Steve thinks that Iran should not have nuclear weapons.
But how does he think the United States should?
I'm not sure we have a policy as such.
I mean, an editorial policy.
I can't remember him writing anything on it. But he clearly believes that, you know, that nuclear proliferation should not be allowed to continue, and that Iran should be hedged in.
Anything dramatic in Venezuela that the United States should be worried about? Because they're a huge supplier of oil, and I know you track everything in oil.
Yes, they've threatened to cut off supplies of oil to the United States. That's probably more rhetoric than having any real effect, because they're not a major... they're a supplier of oil, but they're not a major. But, Venezuela has now declared itself with Ecuador and Cuba as being the axis of good, and they will... continue to do their mischief against American interests. I don't know.
Bernanke, he's the new Fed chairman. What's the feeling about him?
He had his first run out in front of Congress and played, I think, very straight down the line. Sounded just sufficiently tough enough for the markets to feel that he would remain enough of an inflation hawk. And I think really he said what the markets wanted to hear, which essentially was nothing that surprised them. It's more at this point, more of the Greenspan policy, keeping the line on interest rates, you know.
So we always talk about this. Where are interest rates going, Paul?
They'll go up or down, except when they stay sideways. No, we've talked about this a lot. I mean, we've got this very peculiar effect now that the long-term rates are... below short-term rates, which is not the natural order of things.
It's the inverted yield curve. We talk about it on our last show.
We do. I mean, since we last talked, I mean, we've seen the return of the 30-year Treasury bond.
Right.
And partly that's driven by the need for the big investing institutions like pension funds to have a lot of long-term
assets. They use it to hedge.
Yeah. And also they've got a lot of long-term pension funding they have to fund. So you would think that might have some effect in edging long-term interest rates up. But again, as we've discussed before, as long as there is this huge pool of foreign-owned American treasury assets out there...
The rumor that I hear, and I talk to traders all the time, is that China really has a lot of bonds.
China has a lot of bonds. Japan has a lot of bonds.
They've disoriented the Ginnie Mae market, by the way. There's a big spread between the Fannie Mae and the Ginnie Mae. Let me explain that to the audience. Ginnie Mae is a government-guaranteed bond instrument. Fannie Mae is an implied guarantee. And usually there's a sort of a little bit of a spread between the two. You get a little bit more money because you're getting less guarantee on a Fannie Mae. But now it seems there's a shortage of finding Ginnie Mae's. And the rumor is that China is holding those things. Now, why is that dangerous? Let's talk about bonds in general, because if they decide to sell those bonds, they could collapse the market in certain ways and interest rates would go either...
It's a double-edged sword, though, for anyone who holds a lot of American treasury assets or government-backed assets, because if you do that, you're wrecking your own wealth as well. I mean, it's a scorched earth policy. So you're sort of damned if you do it and damned if you don't.
So you're saying if you're at a Chinese treasury and you got these bonds in there, at a par, let's say, and then you got to sell them and you're only getting 80 cents, so your net worth is going down 20%. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and if you do it on a large scale, then obviously you would force the price down even more. So you'd be.
I'm just giving a metaphor.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, the point being that.
So you're hurting your own wealth.
Exactly. And you would only do that for really political reasons. So if you did
right,
that for
because
reasons,
you don't care about your mark to market if you're the Chinese government. You care about the political energy you get out of such a thing.
Yeah.
The United States monitors that very carefully.
It does. I mean, you can look in the Treasury publishes the figures of who owns, who holds what. So
how active is Snow? Is it? You don't hear much about him, the Treasury.
Well, they always say the best Treasury secretaries are the ones you don't hear from because they're quietly going about their business, and it's normally the ones who start, jaw that.
So you think he's
problems.
An effective Treasury minister?
In as much as anyone can in this day and age, because markets so swamp the government in the amounts of money they can direct. That all, in many ways, Treasury secretaries can only really limit the damage rather than, make things good.
Are you?
For example, what he says about, China and the currency, for example, which is the one thing you do tend to hear him speak on. I mean, that's not going to make any difference at all. You'd have to talk the Chinese currency down so much, there's just no way that's going to happen.
General Motors going broke.
You tell me. They've got a lot of cash they've got to get through first. One of the smartest things they did was raise all that money. They've got a big, fat cash cushion, and that'll keep them going for a bit.
Ford?
Nowhere near as solid a position as GM, but in terms of their balance sheet, but probably a better range of cars.
Real estate bubble? Is there such a thing? Are you writing about that?
We've written a lot about that. And I think the thing about the real estate bubble is that it's real in very limited numbers of places, especially on the coasts and particularly on the East Coast and the North, Northeast. But we're going to be seeing a gentle deflation of that where it occurs. We're not going to be seeing a big door going bust like it did in the early 90s. And also the other thing, of course, is the whole mortgage market has changed so much since the 90s because the banks now securitize their mortgages, so they're not sitting on the risk themselves. They've sold it off to other parties. So you won't get that big rush of foreclosures when equity values and mortgages fail.
I got to explain that to the audience because it's sophisticated. Usually when a person bought a house, a bank would normally lend you the money and keep that on their books. And they would make the spread between what their cost of money was and what their profit was. Now these things are all bundled up and sold as CMOs, collateralized mortgage agreements, to Wall Street. So you have a trustee who looks at thousands of pieces. So your home mortgage might be in Dubai, owned by some hedge fund in Dubai or something, right?
It's very possible, yeah.
This is something 20 years ago no one even dreamed about. Paul, we're running out of time. It's always a pleasure. And one last question. Iraq for America. Where are we?
The long war has a long way to go.
Okay. He's generally right, except we have to test him on interest rates. We didn't ask him the real question, where will rates be by the end of the year? We'll save it for the next trip. We'll be right back with Scott Levinson, who's going to teach us about how the polls are doing in the United States. Who's going to win all these elections? Another prophet. We'll see how good he is.
Welcome home, man.
We're back, and we have Scott Levinson on, who knows a lot about what's going on in the Democratic Party amongst all the campaigns. He's a pollster and an advisor, consultant, I guess, to Democratic candidates. You have any candidates right now that you're advising?
We've obviously been helping the Spitzer campaign on their race a little bit.
I've been out of town. Tell me, Swayze from Swazi. Is he running? I don't know. He is running.
He's a declared candidate. I don't think many people think he has much more than a snowball's chance, but he's a formidable guy.
Is being funded by Langone and Grasso and that whole group.
He definitely has support from those people who the Attorney General might not have pleased during his tenure. And the Attorney General, in his zeal to do his job well, I believe, has made some enemies along the way, has ruffled some feathers. I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing, but often what results in that is you have opposition. And
is there
a
Republican candidate?
The Republican Party in the state, as different from it is, it national discipline can't seem to get its act together. There's a tremendous amount of infighting. Their state chairman is promoting a guy.
Well, you don't lose sleep over that.
Oh, no. We rejoice. We rejoice in these things because often it's the other way around, Leon, as you well know. And this year we're seeing a tremendous change in the environment because the Republican state chairman is promoting this Bill Weld, who has really not
former governor of Massachusetts
and not much support in the rank and file Republican state committee, and that's a real problem. You have a guy like John Faso.
You predict Spitzer will be governor?
I predict Elliot Spitzer will be the next
governor
of the state.
I told you he'd become a prophet, and he's probably right on that one. Who will become the Attorney General? That's a big thing. Andy Cuomo, Bill Green. Green. What's his name? Mark Green. And who else? There's another one in there. Who's running?
Denise O'Donnell.
But who's the main contest?
This is
Green
a race generally perceived between Andrew Cuomo and Mark Green. In full disclosure, we're doing work for Andrew Cuomo. These are two formidable guys. Andrew Cuomo is a very accomplished housing secretary under Bill Clinton and ran HUD from what was perceived to be an agency that was under siege to be one that was remarked as being universally doing great work across the country. And I think he's given a lot of credit for that and a lot of credit for his homeless work. I think Mark Green is still suffering, coming off a big loss where he was perceived to be the next mayor. I don't think...
Where's Freddie Faria today? Do you know?
Where is Freddie Faria today? He's been very quiet since the election, and
Does he have a political future?
I don't know if the borough president has a political future, but I will tell you he's a man who I have no doubt is very happy to get back to some sense of normalcy in his life. He loves his family, he has a good marriage, and is devoted to his family, and running for public office and being an elected official is not a normal life, Leon. These principles.
So you're telling me that Hillary Clinton is not a normal person?
No, I didn't say she's she is everything but abnormal. But I'm saying the life that one has to lead when you're under the spotlight constantly, when you cannot be off camera in any way, shape, or form, is a very big strain on these people and their families. But I will tell you, I was listening to your previous
Paul Maybe about the port deal.
About the port deal, and I was with the Senator Clinton the other night, and I will tell you the visceral reaction to this port deal is very deep. And though I agree,
why?
I think
Paul made a very good statement, and he's an economic.
He was great. He made a very good statement on
a
number of fronts, and I think most of us who understand the nature of large corporate takeovers understand this is basically one large company taking over another large company. But I don't think the administration can have it both ways. And that's the problem.
Why are they going to have it both ways?
There's been a certain zeal, a certain passion to their anti-terrorism stance, their anti-authoritarian stance, their position politically against tyranny in the region. And I think this often runs contrary, certainly to the Bush's long-term history.
It's a political situation.
But with the Bush administration and with the family over time, I think what we've seen is the economic interest and the economic relationships and the long-term relationships between them and families in the Middle East.
Yeah, but this was a takeover. I mean, I don't know a lot about the issue. I was out of the country, but I know enough about corporate and securities, what happens in takeovers and mergers and acquisitions. And I talked to some people who told me that this company is a very effective company in managing ports. They're excellent.
And P&O has a long history in this, but the timing of this, first of all, politically.
Did Bush know? Do you think he knew about this?
Well, if he didn't know, he had advisors that should have given him a heads up that this was a hot potato issue. This is more legs than
centipedes. So you think he'll back off?
This is going to be a very interesting thing to watch play out. Just before I came on tonight, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey announced that they're going to sue to stop the deal.
So he'll back off. So it's a no-win for him.
And well, the problem for the president is almost on cue. We're into the sixth year of his presidency, which is about the time the American public and the Congress gets tired of an administration. And for the first time, we're seeing severe breaks in the Republican leadership.
He's not running again, so he can go on principle. He can say, look, I'm going to go. I'm going to veto it. So then they'll try to override his veto. It doesn't hurt his pension. He'll still get Secret Service. He'll get an office. The history books will say, you know what? This challenge was great. Harry Truman did something like this with the steel industry. I don't remember the whole ramification, but he made a command decision, which was very... I think he froze the price of steel or something at one time before I was born or you were born. And there was a big decision, and history showed that it was the right thing, but at the time it was a bad political decision. So, you know, maybe, you know, Jimmy Carter, I told you, is backing him. He's my favorite Democrat.
Jimmy Carter, the most underrated president, certainly, of our generation.
Have no argument with me on that.
I mean, he was a man ahead of his time. The problem with President Carter, if you didn't ask, but my unsolicited free opinion is he presented a complex worldview. And complex worldviews are inherently difficult to sell.
Yeah, it's like television. You got to be able to sell it in TV talk.
One of the reasons why Republicans are so successful is their worldview message is much simpler. It's built around black and white. And
Ronald Reagan, his success story. Jimmy Carter built it all for Ronald Reagan. He broke the Soviet Union with the satellite and human rights policy. We know that's a fact, but Reagan gets the credit. Bush probably set Clinton up economically. But tell me about the presidential race. It's really, a lot of people want to run. It's not only Hillary Clinton, right?
It's not only
Hillary. I got a card from John Edwards today. What's he doing?
John Edwards is certainly, he's going around the country. He's speaking constantly. Mark Warner from Virginia is widely respected.
Yeah.
Joe Biden, people continue to talk about it, even with the Neil Kinnock history.
With his new hairdo.
But I will tell you the X factor around Senator Clinton. And I will, first of all, her people are very disciplined. They're focused on re-election. This is a re-election year. And they don't speak about anything
but re-election.
It doesn't matter, but
the press does.
It doesn't matter because this woman has an X factor. I was with her Wednesday night of this week where she raised money after money, apartment to apartment. She's going to have no shortage of money from which to run from. And she is able to tap into something in the American population that is hard to poll. It's almost unprecedented, certainly in the studies our firm has done in voting patterns in this state.
So you believe she can win?
I believe she can win. And this is, whereas several years ago I thought there was a big negative piece of this, what I think is most interesting to watch is the evolution around her health care policy positions of the early 90s. I think whereas 5-7 years ago this was seen as a big defeat of hers, a failure for the senator, I think what people realize now is she was a woman ahead of her time. That what that was a courageous act. And that a decade later plus, we're still dealing with a healthcare crisis.
She has some issues with the Iraqi war. She has some issues in foreign policy. It's not going to be that simple.
No, this is it's a heavy lift.
It's not a walk away.
Absolutely not.
And who will, and your guess, the Republicans, who will they put up? Just a good guess.
I think John McCain is a very, very strong.
Can he get the nomination?
I do think he can get the nomination, and I think he's a very formidable, difficult candidate.
Is Giuliani in this game at all, or he doesn't have any footings?
Well, he is and will remain America's mayor.
No, but is he trying to run? Do you know?
He has told people that I know who are close to him to keep their powder dry. I think he's certainly keeping his options open, but my understanding is he has a tremendous amount of freedom and a tremendous amount of economic wealth doing what he's doing now.
Thank you. You heard it from Scott. I told you he was a prophet. His prophecy is Hillary can make it as president, and Spitzer will probably be the next governor. He's doing work for Spitzer, so that's he probably should think that way. He probably think Andy Cohen is going to win, too, because he's doing work for him. But he hasn't committed to that.
They pay me for these
prophets. They pay me, right. So what we want to do is get some insights. We got them. And now we're on to Jeff Gourock, who's going to talk about Judaism's encounter with American sports. I don't know. I played basketball. I don't know what it had to do with my Judaism, but he's going to explain it to me anthropologically and sociologically. Don't leave us.
Hands can do incredible things. Now they can even help save a life with hands-only CPR. If you see an adult suddenly collapse, just call 911, then push hard and fast in the center of the chest until help arrives. Learn more at handsonlycpr.org.
You have seen the book. It's written by Jeff Gourock, who's a professor of history, American history at Yeshiva University. It's called Judaism's Encounter with American Sports. It's a pretty esoteric topic. If I say Bonnie Ross, what do you say?
Great fighter.
If I say Hank Greenberg?
Very complex figure. Very important in American Jewish history for the issue of his playing or not playing on the High Holy Days.
Sandy Koufax.
Same story. You use Hank Greenberg from 1934, Sandy Koufax 1965. You see two different trends in how Jews are treated in the United States. 1934, Greenberg is pressured tremendously to play on our holiest days. He ends up playing on Rosh Hashanah, doesn't play on Yom Kippur. And this is an era where Jews of Detroit are under great pressure from Father Coughlin, Ku Klux Klan, Henry Ford. If a metaphor for understanding where Jews are in Detroit, look at Hank Greenberg in 1934. So you fast forward to 1965, Sandy Koufax, greatest athlete of his time. If you want to understand where Jews are in the mind of America, look at the fact that he announces he will not play on Yom Kippur. And America understands that a Jew in a cultural pluralistic America might want to observe its holiday. And it's a funny sidebar to the story. He doesn't pitch. His roommate, Don Drysdale, pitches. And from an economic point of view, you may recall that the two of them held out for $100,000 each. That's how much salaries were back then. And Drysdale pitches terribly. And when Walt Alstom takes him out of the game, he says these immortal words of Jewish history. He says, "Skip, I bet you wish today was also a Jew, because he pitched lousy."
Right. Okay?
So you can use Koufax and you can use Drysdale as more than just their achievements on the field, Koufax or Greenberg, but what they say about...
There's a movie made about Greenberg.
Sure.
I remember the lady who did it. She came to my office.
Aviva Kepner, sure.
Right. It was pretty successful.
Very good movie.
Right. Yeah. So why did you pick this topic?
Well, I'm a historian, and I'm also an athlete, and I'm also a coach. And after doing 12 books of American Jewish history, I decided at age 50, this one's for me. And as a historian, it's very important for me to have my audience understand that to understand, let's say, the immigrant experience, it's important to know how Jews eat and how they dress and how they recreate and how they play. And the major theme of this book is how something that's foreign to Jewish culture, namely sports, enters into the life of Jews in the United States. And all the conflicts that ensue in being both a Jew on so many different levels.
Jeffrey, the Maccabiah in Israel started during the Palestinian days.
Right, in the 20th century.
Jews were always involved in sports, weren't they?
Jews were involved in sports in ancient times.
Right.
And then there's a medieval time out.
Yeah.
And then in modern times, the Maccabiah is established.
Right.
It's an outgrowth of the Zionist orientation,
right.
which is very modern.
Right.
So my focus is on the 20th century.
Right.
and how sports becomes very significant in the lives of American Jews.
Absolutely.
And even so far as to look at groups like what you might call right-wing Orthodox groups, I say in the book it's an irresistible force.
There was a kid who played for a high school in Baltimore, a very famous kid.
Right.
And he wanted to go to the University of Maryland.
Correct.
And one of the things was he couldn't play on a Sabbath.
Right.
And what happened to this boy?
Well, he ended up not... By the way, there's more on Tamir Goodman in this book than anything else, because he was the fulfillment of an Orthodox Jewish fantasy.
Right.
Namely, that someone would be so good that the world would turn itself upside down to accommodate him.
Right.
Frankly, the problem with Tamir Goodman was that it really wasn't a true test. He wasn't that good
a player.
And yet, the Jewish community, it's more than Orthodox community, was so swept up in this that even when he left the yeshiva to go to a Seventh-day Adventist school, they also don't play on the Sabbath, on
Saturday. Did he play college ball?
He played for a year for Towson State.
And then?
And then he went off to Israel. He tried out with Maccabi Tel Aviv, and then they dumped him into the third division.
Couldn't make it.
He just wasn't that good. But it was, it talks about issues of fantasy life.
All right, Jeff, we don't have a lot of time, and it's an interesting subject. I played basketball, by the way. Where did you go to high school?
I went to Ramaz High School.
Did you play for them?
I was a star player for them.
Star,
a legend of my own mind.
All city,
all Ramaz.
All Ramaz.
Yeah, yeah.
I played for RJJ. Now you want to hear a funny story?
Sure.
RJJ was Rabbi Jacob Joseph. If you watch this show, which I'm sure you do, you remember a couple of weeks ago I interviewed the Nobel Prize winner Professor Oman in economics.
Right.
And we went to the same high school. We found out on this show and had the same teacher, Joey Gansler, who influenced both our lives. He won a Nobel Prize, and I'm interviewing Jeff Gourak. So you can see what it did for both of us.
Right.
I actually played for Yeshiva University in my freshman year for a man called Red Saracek, who died recently, who was a phenomenal coach. He was the coach of coaches in New York. At least Lou Carnesecca used to come down from St. John's. Dolly King used to come down.
Right.
These were all guys who used to come.
Dean Smith used to show up.
Right.
Saracek, Joe Lapchick.
Yeah.
He taught coaches. And almost the day he died, Kevin Lockery, who coached for Miami Heat, used to consult with Saracek on plays.
Is that right?
All sorts of people were constantly asking Shilas questions of Saracek.
And he coached the Scranton Miners.
That is correct, the Scranton Miners.
Boy, but he made me run all the time. Wow, he made us run. He didn't stop. And we used to play at CNT, Central Needle and Trade.
Right. That FIT today.
Yeah,
right.
He was renowned as a coach, and he stayed in Yeshiva. Why did he stay with Yeshiva?
He stayed in Yeshiva because it was very important to him to coach Jewish athletes,
really?
The most Jewish of athletes. And I was privileged to write an obituary for him where I described him as a great coach, a good man, but a better Jew. And that's what Saracek was all about.
But he was a phenomenal coach.
He's a great coach, a great theoretician, tactician.
Very creative. I played for him.
Many of the things that the big guys do today in terms of defenses and offenses.
Was he a ball player himself?
Yes, he played for Stuyvesant High School. He was an all-city player who was better than either of us. And he went on to NYU, and then he came to Yeshiva, and he coached for some 30 years. And
he was also in the sporting goods business with a referee called Lou Eisenstein.
Lou Eisenstein, Circle Sporting Goods in Brooklyn.
Wow, what a memory we have here. If you had to name the five greatest Jewish athletes in the 20th century, where do we go?
Sandy Koufax. Hank Greenberg. I was going to say maybe Sasha Cohen, but she didn't win the gold medal.
How about Dolph Schayes?
Dolph Schayes. In fact, I met Dolph Schayes a couple of weeks ago on a lecture tour up in Syracuse. He at one point was the all-time leading scorer in the NBA.
Right.
Big man. Nice man, too. Yeah.
Max Zaslavsky.
Ozzie Schechtman.
St. John's won the five. You remember them?
A little bit before my time. Even before your time.
No, I don't know. I know the guy. I met the guys who played. They were like a bunch of Jewish ball players played for St. John's, right?
They played for Frank McGuire, I believe. That was a time where Jews couldn't go to a lot of other universities. They were welcomed into St. John's. So there were Jewish players all the time. Ozzie Schechtman, Jewish boy, went to Tilden High School, LIU. Scored the first basket in the history of the BAA, which is a forerunner of the NBA. I had a chance to meet him.
How come no Israeli basketball players made it in the NBA? You had some good guys at University of Connecticut.
Nadav Hennefeld and others.
Some very good ball players.
With all due respect, not that good. The NBA is the elite of the elite. And you know what? There are great players all over the world who don't make it at the NBA level.
I think, I don't know how your research shows, but I think I was a freshman. Red Blumenreich was a very good ball player for Yeshiva, maybe one of the best.
Right.
I believe that the Hawks, St. Louis Hawks, drafted him or at least looked at him. I think he's the only guy that...
In those days, it was much more informal than today, and there's all sorts of talk about guys who had the possibility of playing. This is in the this is the 1950s, but in contemporary times, you know, kids are scouted today from the time they're in diapers almost, so that for a player to emerge at that point, you know, so quickly... is pretty much unusual. But Blumenreich was a great player, and we had some good players at Yeshiva, and we continue to have the most outstanding young people playing for us, not always the greatest basketball players. But
are you in a special league?
We play in the Skyline Conference. We play against Kings Point, Maritime College, Stevens Tech. And one of the nicest things, Leon, is that every year we go on the road and we visit a Jewish community.
I'm going to tell you an anecdote that you didn't know. I played for Yeshiva my freshman year, and we were up playing the University of Scranton. And we were warming up, and all the boys had kippot on. And you know what the warm-up song was? When the Saints Come Marching In.
Well, I have a counter story, and that is we went out to Drew University a few years ago. They were a Methodist school, and our kids walk on, some of them wearing yarmulkes. The referee says they got to take those yarmulkes off. So we say, fine, we're going back to New York. We're not going to tell our kids to take off the yarmulkes. The Drew coach, in exasperation, says, what are you talking about? They've been wearing those yarmulkes for 40 years. Now, for the record, we've worn yarmulkes more than 40 years. Make a long story short, we go in the back room. We get the director of officials from the ECAC on the phone. He says to the referee, you dirty so-and-so, let them wear those yarmulkes. So the game starts. We lose by 29 points.
You lose?
We lose. On the way back, one of the kids says to us, hey, coach, you should have gotten out of town while you had a chance.
But similar thing about the black team that won the NCAA. That's a big movie on that.
It's a metaphor for understanding minority life.
We're running out of time.
Okay.
Stay in sports. Ping pong diplomacy. Beat China. Next week, we'll see you with internet terrorism.